Track 7.
We tramped down to the beach in the morning with rain drumming on our oilskins and cascading from them in sheets. The cloud was right down on the peaks, oily, dark banks that rolled steadily in from the sea to loose their bomb loads of moisture upon the island. The force of the rain lifted a fine, pearly spray from the surface of the sea, and the moving grey curtains reduced visibility to a few hundred yards, so that the island disappeared in a grey haze as we ran out to the reef. Everything in the whaleboat was cold and clammy and running with water. Angelo had to bail regularly, and we huddled miserably in our oilskins while Chubby stood in the stern and slitted his eyes against the slanting, driving rain as he negotiated the channel. The fluorescent orange buoy still bobbed close in beside the reef, and we picked it up, dragged in the end of the hose and connected it to the pump head. It served as an anchor cable, and Chubby could cut the motors. It was a relief to leave the boat, to escape from the cold needle lances of the rain, and go down into the quiet blue mists of the pool. After withstanding considerable pressure from Chubby and me, Angelo had at last succumbed to veiled threats and open bribes and relinquished his ticking mattress stuffed with coconut fibre. Once the mattress was thoroughly soaked with seawater, it sank readily, and I took it down with me in a neat roll tied with line. Only when I'd manoeuvred it through the gunport, down the gun deck, and into the passenger deck, did I cut the line and spread the mattress. Then Sherry and I returned to the hold, where the tiger's head still snarled blindly into the torchlight. 10 minutes' work was all that was necessary to free the head from its nest. As I suspected, this section ended at shoulder level, and the junction area was neatly flanged. Clearly, it would mate with the trunk section of the throne, and the flange would engage the female slot to form a joint that would be strong and barely perceivable. When I rolled the head carefully onto its side, I made another discovery. Somehow I'd taken it for granted that the idol was made from solid gold. But now I saw that, in fact, it was a hollow casting. The actual thickness of metal was only about an inch, and the interior was rough and knobbly to the touch. I realized immediately that a solid idol would have weighed hundreds of tons, and that the cost of such construction would have been prohibitive, even to an emperor who could support the construction of a temple as vast as the Taj Mahal. The thinness of the metal skin had naturally weakened the structure, and I saw immediately, when I turned it, that the head had already suffered damage. The rim of the neck cavity was flattened and distorted, probably during its secret journey through the Indian forests in an unsprung cart, or possibly during the wild death struggles of the dawn light during the cyclone. Bracing myself in the entrance to the hold, I stooped over it to test its weight, and I cradled the head in my arms like the body of a child. Gradually I increased the strength of my lift, and was pleased but not surprised when it came up in my arms. It was, of course, tremendously weighty, and it required all of my strength from a carefully selected stance, but I could lift it. It weighed not much more than 300 pounds, I thought, as I turned awkwardly under the oppressive load of gleaming gold and laid it gently on the coir mattress that Sherry was holding ready to receive it. Then I straightened up to rest and massage those parts where the sharp edges of metal had bitten into my flesh. While I did so, I tried a little mental arithmetic. 300 pounds avoirdupois, at 16 ounces to the pound, was 4,800 ounces. At 150 to the ounce, was almost $750,000. That was the intrinsic value of the head alone. There were three other sections to the throne. All were probably heavier and larger. And then there was the value of the stones. It was an astronomic total, but could be doubled or even trebled if the artistic and historical value of the hoard were taken into account. I abandoned my calculations. They were meaningless at this time, and instead I helped Sherry to fold the mattress around the tiger's head and to rope it all into a secure bundle. Then I could use the block and tackle to drag it down to the companion ladder and lower it to the gun deck. Laboriously we dragged it to the gunport, and there we struggled to pass it through the restricted opening. But at last it was accomplished, and we could place the nylon cargo net around it and inflate the airbags. Again, we had to step the mast to lift it aboard. But there was no suggestion that the head should remain covered once we had it safely in the whaleboat. And with what ceremony and aplomb I could muster in the streaming tropical rain, I unveiled it for Chubby and Angelo. They were a most appreciative audience. Their excitement superseded even the miserable sodden conditions. And they crowded about the head to fondle and examine it amid shouted comment and giddy laughter. It was the festive gaiety which our first discovery of the treasure had lacked. I had taken the precaution of slipping my silver travelling flask into my gear bag, and now I laced the steaming mugs of black coffee with liberal portions of Scotch whisky, and we toasted each other and the golden tiger in the steaming liquor, laughing while the rain gushed down upon us and rattled on the fabulous treasure at our feet. At last I swilled out my mug over the side and checked my watch. "We'll do another dive," I decided. "You can start the pump again, Chubby." Now we knew where to continue the search, and after I had broken out the remains of the case that had contained the head, I saw in the opening beyond the side of a similar crate, and I pressed the hose into the area to clear it of dirt before proceeding. My excavations must have unbalanced the rotting heap of ancient cargo, and it needed only the further disturbance caused by suction of the hose to dislodge a part of it. With a groaning and rumbling, it collapsed around us, and instantly the swirling clouds of muck defeated the efforts of the hose to clear them, and we were plunged into darkness once more. I groped quickly for Sherry through the darkness, and she must have been searching for me, for our hands met and held. With a squeeze, she reassured me that she'd not been hit by the sliding cargo, and I could begin to clear out the fouled water with the suction hose. Within 5 minutes, I could make out the yellow glow of Sherry's torch through the murk, and then her shape, and the vague jumble of freshly revealed cargo. With Sherry beside me, we moved further into the hold again. The slide had covered the wooden crate on which I'd been working, but in exchange it had exposed something else that I recognized instantly, despite its sorry condition, for it was almost exactly as I'd described it to Sherry the previous evening, even down to the detail of the rod that ran through the locking device and the double padlocks. The paymaster's chest was, however, almost eaten through with rust, and when I touched it, my hand came away, smeared with the chalky red of iron oxide. In each end of the case were heavy iron carrying rings, which had most likely swiveled at one time, but were now solidly rusted into the metal side. But still, they enabled me to get a firm grip, and gently to work the chest out of the clutching bed of muck. It came free in a minor storm of debris, and I was able to lift it fairly easily. I doubt that the total weight exceeded 150 pounds, and I felt certain that most of that was made up by the massive iron construction. After the enormously heavy head in its soft, bulky mattress, it was a minor labour to get the smaller, lighter chest out of the wreck, and it needed only a single airbag to lift it, dangling out of the gunport. Once again, the tide and surf were pouring alarmingly into the pool, and the whaleboat tossed and kicked impatiently as we lifted the chest inboard and laid it on the canvas-covered heap of scuba bottles in the bows. Then at last Chubby could start the motors and take us out through the channel. We were still all high with excitement, and the silver flask passed from hand to hand. "What's it feel like to be rich, Chubby?" I called. And he took a swallow from the flask, screwing up his eyes and then coughing at the sting of the liquor before he grinned at me. Just like before, man. No change yet. What are you going to do with your share? Sherry insisted. It's a little late in the day, Miss Sherry. If only I had it 20 years ago, then I have use for it. And how? He took another swallow. That's the trouble. You never have it when you're young, and when you're old, it's just too damned late. What about you, Angelo? Sherry turned to him as he perched on the rusted pay chest, with his gypsy curls heavy with rain dangling onto his cheeks and the droplets clinging in the long, dark eyelashes. You're still young. What will you do? Miss Sherry, I've been thinking here, sitting about it. Thinking. And already, I've got a list from here to St. Mary's and back. It took 2 trips from the beach to the camp before we'd both the head and the chest out of the rain and into the cave we were using as the storerooms. Chubby lit 2 gas lanterns, for the lowering sky had brought on the evening prematurely, and we gathered around the chest while the golden head snarled down upon us from a place of honour, an earthen ledge hewn into the back of the cave. With a hacksaw and a jenny bar, Chubby and I began to work on the locking device, and found immediately that the decrepit appearance of the metal was deceptive. Clearly, it had been hardened and alloyed. We broke 3 hacksaw blades in the first half hour, and Sherry professed to be severely shocked by my language. I sent her to fetch a bottle of Shiraz Regal from our cave to keep the workers in good cheer, and Chubby and I took the Scottish equivalent of a tea break. With renewed vigour, we resumed our assault on the case, but it was another 20 minutes before he'd sawn through the rod. By that time it was dark outside the cave. The rain was still hissing down steadily, but the soft clatter of the palm fronds heralded the rising westerly wind that would disperse the storm clouds by morning. With the locking rod sawn through, we started it from its ring bolts with a 2-pound hammer from the toolbox. Each blow loosened a soft patter of rust scales from the surface of the metal, and it required a number of goodly blows to drive the rod from the clutching fist of corrosion. And even when it was cleared, the lid wouldn't lift. Although we hammered it from 12 different directions, and I treated it with a further laying on of abuse, it would not yield. I called another whiskey break to discuss the problem. "What about a stick of jelly?" Chubby suggested, with a gleam in his eye. But reluctantly I had to restrain him. "We need a welding torch," Angelo announced. "Brilliant!" I applauded him ironically, for I was fast losing my patience. "The nearest welding set is 50 miles away, and you make a remark like that." It was Sherry who discovered the secondary locking device, a secret pinning through the lid that hooked into recesses in the body of the chest. It obviously needed a key to release this, but for lack of it, I selected a 1/2-inch punch and drove it into the keyhole, and by luck I caught the locking arm and snapped it. Chubby started on the lid again, and this time it came up stiffly on corroded hinges with some of the rotting, evil-smelling contents sticking to the inside of it and tearing away from the main body of aged brown cloth. It was woven cotton fabric, a wet, solid brick of it, and I guessed that it had been cheap native robes or bolts of cloth used as packing. I was about to explore further, but suddenly found myself in the second row, looking over Sherry North's shoulder. "You'd better let me do this," she said. "You might break something." "Ah, come on," I protested. "Why don't you get yourself another drink?" she suggested placatingly, as she began lifting off layers of sodden fabric. The suggestion had some merit, I thought, so I refilled my mug and watched Sherry expose a layer of cloth-wrapped parcels. Each was tied with twine that fell apart at the touch, and the first parcel also disintegrated as she tried to lift it out. Sherry cupped her hands around the decaying mass and scooped it onto a folded tarpaulin placed beside the chest. The parcel contained scores of small nutty objects, varying in size from slightly larger than a match head to a ripe grape, and each had been folded in a wisp of paper, which, like the cotton, had completely rotted away. Sherry picked out one of these lumpy objects and rubbed away the remains of paper between thumb and forefinger to reveal a large, shiny blue stone, cut square and polished on one face. "Sapphire?" she guessed, and I took it from her and examined it quickly in the lantern light. It was opaque, and I contradicted her. No, I think it's probably lapis lazuli." The scrap of paper still adhering to it was faintly discoloured with a blue dye. "Ink, I should say." I crumpled it between my fingers. "At least Roger the Colonel took the trouble to identify each stone. He probably wrapped each piece in a numbered slip of paper, which related to a master sketch of the throne to enable it to be reassembled." "Well, there's no hope of that now," said Sherry. "I don't know," I said. "It'd be a hell of a job, but it should still be possible to put it all together again." Amongst our stores was a roll of plastic packets, and I sent Angelo to ferret it out. As we opened each parcel of rotted fabric, we superficially cleaned the stones it contained and packed each lot in a separate plastic packet. It was slow work, even though we all contributed, and after almost 2 hours of it, we had filled dozens of packets with thousands of semi-precious stones. Lapis lazuli, beryl, tiger's eye, garnets, verdite, amethyst, and half a dozen others of whose identity I was uncertain. Each stone had clearly been lovingly cut and exactingly polished to fit into its own niche in the golden throne. It was only when we'd unpacked the chest to its last layer that we came upon the stones of greater value. The old colonel had obviously selected these first, and they'd gone into the lowest layer of the chest. I held a transparent plastic packet of emeralds to the lantern light, and they burned like a bursting green star. We all stared at it as if mesmerized, while I turned it slowly to catch the fierce white light. I laid it aside, and Sherry dipped once more into the chest, and after a moment's hesitation brought out a smaller parcel. She rubbed away the damp, crumbling material that was wound thick about the single stone it contained. Then she held up the great Mogul diamond in the cupped palm of her hand. It was the size of a pullet's egg, cut into a faceted cushion shape, just as Jean-Baptiste Regnier had described it so many hundred years ago. The glittering array of treasure we had handled before in no way dimmed the glory of this stone, as all the stars of the firmament cannot dull the rising of the sun. They paled and faded away before the brilliance and luster of the great diamond. Sherry slowly extended her cupped hand towards Angelo, offering it to him to hold and examine. But he snatched his hands away and clasped them behind his back, still staring at the stone in superstitious awe. Sherry turned and offered it to Chubby, but with gravity he declined also.
"Give it to Mr. Harry. I guess he deserves to be the one."
I took it from her and was surprised that such unearthly fire could be so cold to touch. I stood up and I carried it to where the tiger's head stood snarling angrily in the unwavering light of the lanterns, and I pressed the diamond into the empty eye socket. It fitted perfectly. I used my bait knife to close the golden clasps that held it firmly in place, and which the old colonel had probably opened with a bayonet a century and a quarter ago. I stood back then, and I heard the small gasps of wonder. With the eye returned to its socket, the golden beast had come to life. It seemed now to survey us with an imperial mien, and at any instant we expected the cave to resound to its crackling, wicked snarl of anger. I went back and took my place in the squatting circle around the rusted chest, and we all stared up at the golden tiger head. We seemed like worshippers in some ancient heathen rite, crouched in awe before the fearsome idol. Chubby, my old well-beloved and trusted buddy, you'll earn yourself an entry on the title page of the Book of Mercy if you pass me that bottle, I said. And that broke the spell. They all recovered their voices, competing fiercely for a turn to speak. And it wasn't long before I had to send Sherry to fetch another bottle to lubricate dry throats. We all got more than a little drunk that night, even Sherry North. And she leaned against me for support as we finally made a riotous way through the rain to our own cave. You really are corrupting me, Fletcher. She stumbled into a puddle and nearly brought me down. This is the first time ever I've been stoned. Be of good cheer, my pretty sweeting. Your next lesson in corruption follows immediately. When I woke, it was still dark, and I rose from our bed, careful not to disturb Sherry, who was breathing lightly and evenly in the darkness. It was cool, so I pulled on shorts and a woolen jersey. Outside the cave, the west wind had broken up the cloud banks. It had stopped raining, and the stars were showing in the breaks of the heavens, giving me enough light to read the luminous dial of my wristwatch. It was a little after 3 o'clock. As I sought my favourite palm tree, I saw that we'd left the lantern burning in the storage cave. I finished what I had to do and went up to the lighted entrance. The open chest stood where we'd left it, as did the priceless golden head with its glittering eye. And suddenly I was struck with the consuming terror that the miser must feel for his hoard. It was so vulnerable. Where thieves break in, I thought. And it was not as though there were any shortage of them in the immediate vicinity. I had to get it all stowed away safely, and tomorrow would be too late. Despite the pain in my head and the taste of stale whiskey in the back of my throat, it must be done now, but I needed help. Chubby roused to my first soft call at the entrance of his cave, and came out into the starlight resplendent in his striped pyjamas, and as wide awake as if he'd drunk nothing more noxious than mother's milk before retiring. I explained my fears and misgivings. Chubby grunted in agreement, and went with me back to the storage cave. The plastic bags of gemstones we repacked casually into the iron chest, and I secured the lid with a length of nylon line. The golden head we shrouded carefully in a length of green canvas, tarpaulin, and we carried them both down into the palm grove, before returning for spades and the gas lantern. By the flat white glare of the lantern, we worked side by side, digging 2 shallow graves in the sandy soil, within a few feet of where the gelignite and the FN rifle with its spare ammunition were already buried. We laid the chest and golden head away and covered them. Afterwards, I brushed the soil over them with a palm frond to wipe out all trace of our labours. "You are happy now, Harry?" Chubby asked at last. "Yes, I'm happier, Chubby. You go and get some sleep, yeah?" He went away amongst the palms, carrying the lantern and not looking back. I knew I would not be able to sleep again, for the spade work had cleared my head and roused my blood. It would be senseless to return to the cave and try to lie quietly beside Sherry until dawn. I wanted to find some quiet and secret place where I could think out my next moves in this intricate game of chance in which I was involved. I chose the path that led to the saddle between the lesser peaks, and as I climbed it, the last of the clouds were blown aside and revealed a pale yellow moon, still a week from full. Its light was strong enough to show me the way to the nearest peak, and I left the path and toiled upwards to the summit. I found a place protected from the wind and settled into it. I wished that I had a cheroot with me, for I think better with one of them in my mouth. I also think better without a hangover, but there was nothing I could do about that either. After 30 minutes, I had firmly decided that we must consolidate what we'd gained to this point. The miser's fears, which had assailed me earlier, still persisted, and I had been given clear warning that the wolf pack was out hunting. As soon as it was light, we would take what we'd salvaged so far, the head and the chest, and run down the islands to St. Mary's to dispose of them in the manner which I had so carefully planned. There would be time later to return to Gunfire Reef and recover what remained in the misty depths of the pool. Once the decision had been made, I felt a lift of relief, a new lightness of spirit, and I looked forward to the solution of the other major trouble that had troubled me for so long. Very soon I would be in a position to call Sherry North's hand and have a sight of those cards which she concealed so carefully from me. I wanted to know what caused those shadows in the blue depths of her eyes and the answers to many other mysteries that surrounded her. That time would soon come. There was a paling of the sky at last, dawn's first pearling light, spread across from the east and softened the harsh, dark plain of the ocean. I rose stiffly from my seat amongst the rocks and picked my way around the peak into the wicked eye of the west wind. I stood there on the exposed face above the camp, with the wind raising a rash of goosebumps along my arms and ruffling my hair. I looked down into the sheltering arms of the lagoon, and in the feeble glimmer of dawn, the darkened ship that was creeping stealthily into the open arms of the bay looked like some pale phantom. Even as I stared, I saw the splash at her bows as she let go her anchor, and she rounded up into the wind, showing her full silhouette, so that I could not doubt that she was the Mandrake. Before I had recovered my wits, she had dropped a boat, which sped in swiftly towards the beach. I fell once on the path, but the force of my headlong descent from the peak carried me on, and with a single roll I was on my feet again, still running. I was panting wildly as I burst into Chubby's cave, and I shouted, "Move, man, move! They're on the beach already!" The two of them tumbled from their sleeping bags. Angelo was tousle-haired and blank-eyed from sleep, but Chubby was quick and alert. "Chubby," I snapped, "go and get that piece out of the ground. Jump, man. They'll be coming up through the grove in a few minutes." He had changed while I spoke, pulling on a shirt and belting his denim breeches. He grunted an acknowledgement. "I'll follow you in a minute." And he ran out into the feeble light of dawn. "Angelo, snap out of it." I grabbed his shoulder and shook him. "I want you to look after Miss Sherry, hear?" He was dressed now, and he nodded owlishly at me. "Come on." I half-dragged him as we ran across to my cave. I dragged her out of bed, and while she dressed, I told her, "Angelo will go with you. I want you to take a can of drinking water, and the two of you get the hell down to the south of the island. Cross the saddle first, though, and keep out of sight. Climb the peak and hide out in the chimney where we found the inscription. You know what I mean?" "Yes, Harry." "Stay there. Don't go out or show yourself under any circumstances. Understand?" She nodded as she tucked the tail of her shirt into her breeches. "Remember, these people are killers. The time for games is over. This is a pack of wolves we're dealing with."
"Yes, Harry, I know."
"Okay, then." I embraced and kissed her quickly. "Off you go, then." And they went out of the cave, Angelo lugging a 5-gallon can of drinking water, and they trotted away into the palm grove. Quickly, I threw a few items into a light haversack, a box of cheroots, matches, binoculars, water bottle, and a heavy jersey, a tin of chocolate, and of survival rations, a torch. And I buckled my belt around my waist with the heavy bait knife in the sheath. Slinging the strap of the haversack over my shoulder, I also ran from the cave and followed Chubby down into the palm grove towards the beach. I'd run 50 yards when there was the thud-thudding of small arms fire, a shout, and another burst of firing. It was directly ahead of me and very close. I paused and slipped behind the bole of the palm tree while I peered into the lightning shades of the grove. I saw movement, a figure running towards me, and I loosened the bait knife in its sheath and waited until I was sure, before I called softly, "Chubby!" The running figure swerved towards me. He was carrying the FN rifle and the canvas bandolier with spare magazines of ammunition. And he was breathing quickly but lightly as he saw me.
"They spotted me," he grunted. "There are hundreds of the bastards."
At that moment, I saw more movement amongst the trees.
"Well, here they come," I said. "Let's go."
I wanted to give Sherry a clear run, so I didn't take the path across the saddle, but turned directly southwards to lead the pursuit off her scent. We headed for the swamps at the southern end of the island. They saw us as we ran obliquely across their front. I heard a shout answered immediately by others, and then there were five scattered shots, and I saw the muzzle flashes bloom out amongst the trees. A bullet struck a palm trunk high above our heads, a woody thunk. But we were going fast, and within minutes the shouts of pursuit were fading behind us. I reached the edge of the salt marsh and swung away inland to avoid the stinking mudflats. On the first gentle slope of the hills, I halted to listen and to regain our breath. The light was strengthening swiftly now. Within a short while it would be sunrise, and I wanted to be under cover before then. Suddenly, there were distant cries of dismay from the direction of the swamps, and I guessed that the pursuit had blundered into the glutinous mud. That would discourage them fairly persuasively, I thought, and grinned.
"Okay, chubby, let's get on," I whispered.
And as we stood, there was a new sound from a different direction. The sound was muted by distance and by the intervening heights of the ridge, for it came from the seaward side of the island. But it was the unmistakable ripping sound of automatic gunfire. Chubby and I froze into listening attitudes, and the sound was repeated. Another long, tearing burst of machine gun fire. Then there was silence, though we listened for 3 or 4 minutes. "Come on," I said quietly. We could delay no longer, and we ran on up the slope towards the southernmost peak. We climbed quickly in the fast-growing morning light, and I was too preoccupied to feel any qualms as we negotiated the narrow ledge and stepped at last into the deep rock crack where I'd arranged to meet Sherry. The shelter was silent and deserted. But I called without hope. "Sherry, are you there, love?" There was no reply from the shadows, and I turned back to Chubby. They had a good lead on us. They should have been here. And only then did that burst of machine gun fire we had heard earlier take on new meaning. I removed the binoculars from the haversack and then thrust it away into a crack in the rock. "They've run into trouble, Chubby," I told him. "Come on, let's go and find out what happened." Once we were off the ledge, we struck out through the jumble of broken rock towards the seaward side of the island. But even in my haste and dreadful anxiety for Sherry's safety, I moved with stealth, and we were careful not to show ourselves to a watcher in the groves or on the beaches below us. As we crossed the divide of the ridge, a new vista opened before us, the curve of the beach and the jagged black sweep of Gunfire Reef. I halted instantly and pulled Chubby down beside me as we crouched into cover. Anchored in a position to command the mouth of the channel through Gunfire Reef was the armed crash boat from Zimbala Bay, flagship of my old friend Suleiman Dada. Returning to it from the beach was a small motorboat, crowded with tiny figures.
"God damn it," I muttered. "They really had it planned. Manny Resnick has teamed up with Suleiman Dada. That's what took him so long to get here. While Manny hit the beach, Dada was covering the channel, so we couldn't make a bolt for it like we did before. And he had men on the beach. That was the machine gun fire. Manny Resnick sailed Mandrake into the bay to flush us, and Dada had the back door covered. What about Miss Sherry and Angelo? Do you think they got away? Did Dada's men catch them when they crossed the saddle?" "Oh, God," I groaned, and cursed myself for not having stayed with her. I stood up and focused the binoculars on the motorboat as it crawled across the clear waters of the outer lagoon to the anchored crash boat. I can't see them. Even with the aid of the binoculars, the occupants of the dinghy were merely a dark mass, for the morning sun was rising behind them, and the glare off the water dazzled me. I couldn't make out separate figures, let alone recognize individuals. They may have them in the boat, but I can't see. In my agitation, I had left the cover of the rocks and was seeking a better vantage point, moving about on the skyline. Out in the open, I must have been highlit by the same sun rays that were blinding me. I saw the familiar flash and the long white feather of gun smoke blow from the mounted quickfirer on the bows of the crash boat, and I heard the shell coming with a rushing sound like eagle's wings. "Get down!" I shouted to Chubby, and threw myself flat amongst the rocks. The shell burst in very close, with the bright hot glare like the brief opening of a furnace door. Shrapnel and rock fragments trilled and whined around us, and I jumped to my feet. "Run! Run!" I yelled at Chubby, and we jinked back over the skyline just as the next shell passed over us, making us both flinch our heads at the mighty crack of passing shot. Chubby was wiping a smear of blood from his forearm as we crouched behind the ridge. "Okay?" I asked. "A scratch, that's all. Bit of a rock fragment," he growled. "Chubby, I'm going down to find out what happened to the others. No point both of us taking a chance. You wait here." "You're wasting time, Harry. I'm coming with you. Let's go." He hefted the rifle and led the way down the peak. I thought of taking the FN away from him. In his hands it was about as lethal as a slingshot when fired with his closed eyes technique. Then I left it. It made him feel good. We moved slowly, hugging any cover there was and searching ahead before moving forward. However, the island was silent, except for the saw and clatter of the west wind and the tops of the palms, and we saw nobody as we moved up the seaward side of the island. I cut the spoor left by Angela and Sherry as they crossed the saddle above the camp. Their running footsteps had bitten deep into the fluffy soil. Sherry's small, slim prints were overlapped by Angelo's broad, bare feet. We followed them down the slope, and suddenly they shied off the track. They dropped the water can here, and turning abruptly, had separated slightly, as though they'd run side by side for 60 yards. There we found Angelo, and he was never going to enjoy his share of the spoils. He had been hit by 3 of the soft, heavy-caliber slugs. They had torn through the thin fabric of his shirt and opened huge, dark wounds in his back and chest. He had bled copiously, but the sandy soil had absorbed most of it, and already what was left was drying into a thick, black crust. The flies were assembled, crawling gleefully into the bullet holes and swarming on the long, dark lashes around his wide-open and startled eyes. Following her tracks, I saw where Sherry had run on for 20 paces, and then the little idiot had turned back and gone to kneel beside where Angelo lay. I cursed her for that. She might have been able to escape if she'd not indulged in that useless and extravagant gesture. They had caught her as she knelt beside the body and dragged her down through the palms to the beach. I could see the long slide marks in the sand where she'd dug her feet in and tried to resist. Without leaving the shelter of the trees, I looked down the smooth white sand, following their tracks to where the marks of the motorboat's keel still showed in the sand of the water's edge. They had taken her out to the crash boat, and I crouched behind a pile of driftwood and dried palm fronds to stare out at the graceful little ship. Even as I watched, she weighed anchor, picked up speed, and passed slowly down the length of the island to round the point and enter the inner lagoon where Mandrake was still lying at anchor. I straightened up and slipped back through the grove to where I'd left Chubby. He had laid the carbine aside
and he sat with Angelo's body in his arms, cradling the head against his shoulder. Chubby was weeping. Fat, glistening tears slid wearily down the seamed brown cheeks and fell from his jaw to wet the thick, dark curls of the boy in his arms. I picked up the rifle and stood guard over them while Chubby wept for both of us. I envied him the relief of tears, the outpouring of pain that would bring surcease. My own grief was as fierce as Chubby's, for I'd loved Angelo as much, but it was down deep inside where it hurt more. "All right, Chubby," I said at last. "Let's go, man." He stood up with the boy still in his arms, and we moved back along the ridge. In a gully that was choked with rank vegetation, we laid Angelo in a shallow grave that we scraped with our hands, and we covered him with a blanket of branches and leaves that I cut with my bait knife before filling in the grave. I couldn't bring myself to throw sand into his unprotected face, and the leaves made a gentler shroud. Chubby wiped away his tears with the open palm of his hand, and he stood up. "They got Sherry," I told him quietly. "She's aboard the crash boat." "Is she hurt?" he asked.
"I don't think so. Not yet."
"What do you want to do now, Harry?" he asked. And the question was answered for me. Somewhere far off towards the camp, we heard a whistle shrill, and we moved up the ridge to a point where we could see down into the inner lagoon and landward side of the island. Mandrake lay where I'd last seen her, and the Zinballa crash boat was anchored 100 yards closer to the shore. They had seized the whaleboat and were using her to land men on the beach. They were all armed and uniformed. They set off immediately into the palm trees, and the whaleboat ran back to Mandrake. I put the binoculars on to Mandrake and saw that there were developments taking place there also. In the field of the glasses, I recognized Manny Resnick in white open-neck shirt and blue slacks as he climbed down into the whaleboat. He was followed by Lorna Page. She wore dark glasses, a yellow scarf around her pale blonde hair, and an emerald green slack suit. I felt hatred seethe in my guts as I recognized them. Now something happened that puzzled me. The luggage that I'd seen loaded into the rolls at Curzon Street was brought out onto the deck by two of Manny's thugs, and it also was passed down into the whaleboat. A uniformed crew member of Mandrake saluted from the deck, and Manny waved at him in a gesture of airy dismissal. The whaleboat left Mandrake's side and moved in towards the crash boat. As Manny, his lady friend, bodyguards, and luggage were disembarked onto the deck of the crash boat, Mandrake weighed anchor, turned for the entrance of the bay, and set out in a determined fashion for the deep water channel.
"She's leaving," muttered Chubby. "Why is she doing that?"
"Yes, she's leaving," I agreed. "Manny Resnick has finished with her. He's got a new ally now, and he doesn't need his own ship. She's probably costing him 1,000 nicker a day. And Manny always was a shy man with a buck." I turned my glasses onto the crash boat again and saw Manny and his entourage enter the cabin. "There is probably another reason," I muttered.
"What's that, Harry?"
"Manny Resnick and Suleiman Dada will want as few witnesses as possible to what they intend doing now."
"Yeah, yeah, I see what you mean," grunted Chubby.
"I think, my friend, that we're about to be treated to the kind of nastiness that will make what they did to Angelo seem kind by comparison."
"We've got to get Miss Sherry off that boat, Harry."
Chubby was coming out of the daze of grief into which Angelo's killing had thrown him.
"We've got to do something, Harry."
"It's a nice thought, Chubby, I agree, but we aren't going to help her much by getting ourselves killed. My guess is that she'll be safe until they get their hands on the treasure." His huge brown face creased up like that of a worried bulldog.
What are we going to do, Harry? Well, right now we're going to run again. What do you mean?
Listen. I told him.
And he cocked his head. There was the shrill of the whistle again. And then, faintly, we heard voices carried up to us on the wind. Looks like their first effort will be brute strength. They've landed the entire goon squad, and they're going to drive the island and put us up like a brace of cock pheasant. Let's go down and have a go, Chubby growled, and cocked the FN. I got a message for them, from Angelo. Don't be a fool, Chubby, I snapped at him angrily. Now listen to me. I want to count how many men they have. Then, if we get a good chance, I want to try and get one of them alone and have his piece off him. Watch for an opportunity. But don't have a go yet. Play it very cautious, hear? I didn't want to refer to his marksmanship in derogatory tones. Okay, Chubby nodded. You stay this side of the ridge. Count how many of them come down this side of the island. I'll cross over and do the same on the other side. He nodded. I'll meet you at the spot where the crash boat shelled us in 2 hours. What about you, Harry? He made a gesture of handing me the FN, but I didn't have the heart to deprive him of it. Oh, I'll be okay, I told him. Off you go, man. It was a simple task to keep ahead of the line of beaters, for they called to each other loudly to keep their spirits up, and they made no pretense at concealment or stealth, but advanced slowly and cautiously in an extended line. There were 9 of them on my side of the ridge. 7 of them were blacks in naval uniform, armed with AK-47 assault rifles, and 2 of them were Manny Resnick's men. They were dressed in casual tropical gear and carried sidearms. One of them I recognized as the driver of the Rover that night so long ago, and the passenger in the twin-engine Cessna that had spotted Sherry and me on the beach. Once I'd made my head cut, I turned my back on them and ran ahead to the curve of the salt marsh. I knew that when the line of beaters ran into this obstacle, it would lose its cohesion, and that it was likely that some of its members would become isolated. I found an advanced neck of swampland with stands of young mangrove and coarse swamp grass in dense shades of fever green. I followed the edge of this thicket and came upon a spot where a fallen palm tree lay across the neck like a bridge, offering escape in 2 directions. It had collected a dense covering of blown palm fronds and swamp grass, which provided a good hide from which to mount an ambush. I lay in the back of this shaggy mound of dead vegetation, and I had the heavy bait knife in my right hand, ready to throw. The line of beaters came on steadily, their voices growing louder as they approached the swamp. Soon I could hear the rustle and scrape of branches, as one of them came directly down to where I lay. He paused and called when he was about 20 feet from me, and I pressed my face close to the damp earth and peered under the pile of dead branches. There was an opening there, and I saw his feet and his legs below the knees. His trousers were thick blue serge, and he wore grubby white sneakers without socks. At each step, his naked ankles showed very black African skin. It was one of the sailors from the crash boat then, and I was pleased. He'd be carrying an automatic weapon. I preferred that to a pistol, which was how Manny's boys were armed. Slowly I rolled onto my side and cleared my knife arm. The sailor called again, so close and so loud that my nerves jumped, and I felt the tingling flush of adrenaline in my blood. His call was answered from further off, and the sailor came on. I could hear his soft footfalls on the sand, padding towards me. Suddenly he came into full view as he rounded the fall of brushwood. He was 10 paces from me. He was in naval uniform, a blue cap on his head with its gay little red pom-pom on the top, but he carried the vicious and brutal-looking machine gun on his hip. He was a tall, lean youngster in his early 20s, smooth-faced and sweating nervously, so there was a purple-black sheen on his skin
against which his eyes were very white. He saw me and tried to swing the machine gun onto me, but it was on his right hip, and he blocked himself awkwardly in the turn. I aimed for the notch where the two collarbones met, that was framed by the opening of his uniform at the base of his throat. I threw overhand, snapping my wrist into it at the moment of release, so the knife leapt in a silvery blur and thudded precisely into the mark I'd chosen. The blade was completely buried, and only the dark walnut handle protruded from his throat. He tried to cry out, but no sound came, for the blade had severed all his vocal cords, as I intended. He sank slowly to his knees, facing me in a prayerful attitude, with his hands dangling at his sides and the machine gun hanging on its strap. We stared at each other for a moment that seemed to last forever. Then he shuddered violently, and a thick burst of bubbling blood poured from his mouth and nose, and he pitched forward onto the ground. Crouched low, I flipped him onto his back, withdrew the knife against the clinging drag of wet flesh, and cleaned the blade on his sleeve. Working swiftly, I stripped him of his weapon and the spare magazines and the bandolier on his webbing belt, and then, still crouching low, I dragged him by his heels into the gluey mud of the creek and knelt on his chest to force him below the surface. The mud flowed over his face as slowly and thickly as molten chocolate, and when he was totally submerged, I buckled the webbing belt around my waist, picked up the machine gun, and slipped back quietly through the breach that I'd made in the line of beaters. As I ran, doubled over and using all the cover there was, I checked the load on the AK-47. I was familiar with the weapon. I'd used it in Biafra, and I made sure that the magazine was full and that the breech was loaded before I slipped the strap over my right shoulder and held it ready on my hip. When I'd moved back about 500 yards, I paused and took shelter against the trunk of a palm while I listened. Behind me, the line of beaters seemed to have run into trouble against the swamp, and they were trying to sort themselves out. I listened to the shouts and the angry shrill of the whistle. Sounded like a cup final, I thought, and grinned queasily, for the memory of the man I'd killed was still nauseatingly fresh. Now that I'd broken through their line, I turned and struck directly across the island towards my rendezvous with Chubby on the South Peak. Once I was out of the palm groves onto the lower slopes, the vegetation was thicker, and I moved more swiftly through the better cover. Halfway to the crest, I was startled by a fresh burst of gunfire. This time it was the distinctive whip-cracking lash of the FN, a sharper, slower beat than the storm of AK-47 machine gun fire that answered it immediately. I judged by the volume and duration of the outburst that all the weapons involved had emptied magazines in a continuous burst. A heavy silence followed. Chubby was having a go, after all my warnings. Although I was bitterly angry, I was also thoroughly alarmed by what trouble he had gotten himself into. One thing was certain: Chubby had missed whatever he'd aimed at. I broke from a trot into a run and angled upwards towards the crest, aiming to reach the area from which the gunfire had sounded. I burst out of a patch of goose bush into a narrow, overgrown path that followed the direction I wanted, and I turned into it and went into a full run. I topped the rise and almost ran into the arms of one of the uniformed seamen coming in the opposite direction, also at a headlong run. There were 6 of his comrades with him in Indian file, all making the best possible speed on his heels. 30 yards further back was another, who had lost his weapon and whose uniform jacket was sodden with fresh blood. On all their faces were expressions of abandoned terror, and they ran with the single-minded determination of men pursued closely by all the legions of hell. I knew instantly that this rabble were the survivors of an encounter with Chubby Andrews, and that it had been too much for their nerves. They were hell-bent and homeward bound. Chubby's shooting must have improved miraculously, and I made him a silent apology. So much were the seamen involved with the devil behind them that they seemed not to notice me, for the fleeting instant which it took for me to slip the safety catch on the machine gun and brace myself with knees bent and feet spread. I swung the weapon in a short, kicking traverse, aimed low at their knees. With a rate of fire like that of an AK-47, you must go for the legs and rely on another 3 or 4 hits in the body as the man drops through the sheet of fire. It also defeats the efforts of the short barrel to ride up under the thrust of the recoil. They went down in a sprawling, shrieking mass, punched backwards into each other by the savage strike of the soft, heavy caliber slugs. I held the trigger down for the count of 4, and then I turned and plunged off the path into the thick wall of goosebush. It hid me instantly, and I doubled over as I jinked and dodged under the branches. Behind me a machine gun was firing, and the bullets tore and snapped through the thick foliage. None came near me, and I settled back into a quick trot. I guessed that my sudden and completely unexpected attack would have permanently accounted for 2 or 3 of the seamen, and may have wounded 1 or 2 others. However, the effect on their morale would be disastrous, especially coming so soon after Chubby's onslaught. Once they reached the safety of the crash boat, I guessed that the forces of evil would debate long and hard before setting foot on the island again. We had won the second round decisively, but they still had Sherry North. That was the major trump in their hands. As long as they held her, they could dictate the course of the game. Chubby was waiting for me amongst the rocks on the saddle of the peak. The man was indestructible. "Jesus, Harry, where the hell you been?" he growled. "I've been waiting here all morning." I saw that he had retrieved my haversack from the cleft in the rocks where I'd left it. It lay with 2 captured AK-47 rifles and bandoliers of ammunition at his feet. He handed me the water bottle, and only then did I realize how thirsty I was. The heavily chlorinated water tasted like Veuve Clicquot, but I rationed myself to 3 swallows. "I got to apologize to you, Harry. Had a go. Just couldn't help it, man. They were bunched up and standing out in the open like a Sunday school picnic. Just couldn't help myself. Giving them a good old squirt. Dropped 2 of them, and the others ran like hens, shooting their pieces straight up in the air as they go." "Yes," I nodded. "I met them as they crossed the ridge. Heard the shooting. Just about to come and look for you." I sat down on the rock beside him and found my cheroots in the haversack. We each lit one and smoked in grateful silence for a moment, which Chubby spoiled. "Well, we lit a fire under their tails. Don't reckon they'll come back for more. But they still got Miss Sherry, man. Long as they got her, they're winning." "How many were there, Chubby?"
10.
He spat out a scrap of tobacco and inspected the glowing tip of the cheroot.
"But I took out 2, and I think I winged another.
Yes, I met 7 on the ridge. I had to gird them also. Aren't more than 4 left now, and there are 8 more out of my bunch. Say 12, plus those left on board, another 6 or 7. About 20 guns still against us, Chubby."
"Pretty odds, Harry. Well, let's work on it, Chubby." "Let's do that, Harry."
I selected the newest and least abused of the 3 machine guns, and there were 5 full magazines of ammunition for it. I cached the discarded weapon under a slab of flat rock and loaded and checked the other. We each had another short drink from the water bottle, and then I led the way cautiously along the ridge, keeping off the skyline, back towards the deserted camp. From the spot at which I had first spotted the approach of the Mandrake, we surveyed the whole northern end of the island. As we guessed they would, Manny and Suleiman Dada had taken all their men off the island. Both the whaleboat and the smaller motorboat were moored alongside the crash boat. There was much confused and meaningless activity on board, and as I watched the scurrying figures, I imagined the scenes of terrible wrath and retribution which were taking place in the main cabin. Suleiman Dada and his new protégé were certainly wreaking a fearful vengeance on their already badly beaten and demoralized troops. "I want to get out of the camp, Chubby. See what they left for us," I said at last, and handed him the binoculars. "Keep watch for me. 3 quick shots as a warning signal." "Okay, Harry," he agreed. But as I stood up, there was a renewed outbreak of feverish activity on board the crash boat. I took the glasses back from Chubby and watched Suleiman Dada emerge from the cabin and make a laborious ascent to the open bridge. In his white uniform, bedecked with medals that glittered in the sunlight, and attended by a host of helpers, he reminded me of a fat white queen termite being moved from its royal cell by swarming worker ants. The transfer was effected at last, and as I watched through the binoculars, I saw an electronic bullhorn handed to Suleiman. He faced the shore, lifted the hailer to his mouth, and through the powerful lens I saw his lips moving. Seconds later, the sound reached us, clearly, magnified by the instrument and carried by the wind.
"Harry Fletcher, I hope you can hear me."
The deep, well-modulated voice was given a harsher sound by the amplifier. "I plan to put on a demonstration this evening which will convince you of the necessity of cooperating with me. Please be in a position where you can watch. You will find it fascinating. 9 o'clock this evening on the after deck of this ship. It's a date, Harry. Don't miss it." He handed the bullhorn to one of his officers and went below.
"They're going to do something to Sherry," muttered Chubby,
and fiddled disconsolately with the rifle in his lap. "Well, we'll know at 9, I said, and watched the officer with the bullhorn climb from the deck into the motorboat. They set off on a slow circuit of the island, stopping every half mile to shout a repetition of Suleiman Dada's invitation to me at the silent tree-lined shore. He was very anxious for me to attend. "All right, Chubby," I glanced at my watch. "We have hours yet. I'm going down to the camp. Watch out for me." The camp had been ransacked and plundered of most items of value. Equipment and stores had been smashed and scattered about the caves, but still some of it had been overlooked. I found 5 cans of fuel and hid them along with much other equipment that might be of value. Then I crept cautiously down into the grove and learnt with relief that the hiding place of the chest and the golden tiger's head and the other stores were undisturbed. Carrying a 5-gallon can of drinking water and 3 cans of corned beef and mixed vegetables, I climbed again to the ridge where Chubby waited. We ate and drank, and I said to Chubby, "Get some sleep if you can. It's going to be a long, hard night." He grunted and curled up in the grass like a great brown bear, and soon he was snoring softly and regularly. I smoked 3 cheroots, slowly and thoughtfully, but it was only as the sun was setting that I had my first real stroke of genius. It was so clear and simple, and so delightfully apt, that it was immediately suspect, and I re-examined it carefully. The wind had dropped, and it was completely dark by the time I was certain of my idea, and I sat smiling and nodding contentedly as I thought about it. The crash boat was brightly lit. All her ports glowed, and a pair of floods glared whitely down upon the afterdeck, so it looked like an empty stage. I woke Chubby, and we ate and drank again. "Let's go down to the beach," I said. "We'll have a better view from there."
"It might be a trap,"
Chubby warned me morosely. "No, I don't think so. They're all on board, and they're playing from strength. They've still got Sherry. They don't have to try any fancy tricks."
"Man, if they'd do anything to that girl..."
He stopped himself and stood up.
"All right, let's go."
We moved silently and cautiously down through the grove with our weapons cocked and our fingers on the triggers. But the night was still and the grove deserted. We halted among the trees at the top of the beach. The crash boat was only 200 yards away, and I leaned my shoulder against the trunk of a palm and focused my glasses on her. It was so clear and close, that I could read the writing on the lid of a packet from which one of the sentries took and lit a cigarette. We had a front row seat for whatever entertainment Suleiman Dada was planning, and I felt the stir of apprehension and knowledge of coming horror blow like a cold breeze across my skin. I lowered the glasses and whispered softly to Chubby, "Change your piece for mine." And he passed me the long-barreled FN and took the AK-47. I wanted the accuracy of the FN to command the deck of the crash boat. Naturally, there was nothing I could do to intervene while Sherry was unharmed. But if they did anything to her, I would make sure she didn't suffer alone. I squatted down beside the palm tree, adjusted the peep sights of the rifle, and drew a careful bead on the head of the deck guard. I knew I could put a bullet through his temple from where I sat, and when I was satisfied, I laid the rifle across my lap and settled down to wait. The mosquitoes from the swamp whined around our ears, but both Chubby and I ignored them and sat quietly. I longed for a cheroot to soothe the tension of my nerves, but I was forced to forego that comfort. Time passed very slowly, and new fears came to plague me and make the waiting seem even longer than it was. But finally, a few minutes before the promised hour, there was a renewed stirring and bustle on board the crash boat, and once more Suleiman Dada was helped up the ladder by his men, and he took his place at the bridge rail, looking down over the afterdeck. He was sweating heavily, and it had soaked the area around the armpits and across the back of his white uniform jacket. I guessed that he'd passed his own period of waiting by frequent recourse to the whiskey bottle, probably from my own stock that had been plundered from the cave. He laughed and joked with the men around him, his vast belly shaking with mirth, and his men echoed the laughter slavishly. The sound of it carried across the water to the beach. Suleiman was followed by Manny Resnick and his blonde lady friend. Manny was well-groomed and cool-looking in his expensive, casual clothing. He stood slightly apart from the others, his expression aloof and disinterested. He reminded me of an adult at a children's party, setting out a boring and mildly unpleasant duty. In contrast, Lorna Page was excited and shiny-eyed as a girl on her first date. She laughed with Suleiman Dada and leaned expectantly over the rail above the deserted deck. Through the powerful glasses, I could see the flush on her cheeks, which was not rouge. I was concentrating on her, so that it was only when I felt Chubby move suddenly and restlessly and heard his grunt of alarm that I swung the glasses downwards onto the deck. Sherry was there, standing between two of the uniformed sailors. They held her arms, and she looked small and frail between them. She still wore the clothes she had thrown on so hurriedly that morning, and her hair was dishevelled. Her face was gaunt and her expression strained. But it was only when I studied her carefully that I saw what looked like sleepless, dark rings before her eyes were in fact bruises. With a cold chill of anger, I realized that her lips were swollen and puffed up, as though they'd been stung by bees. One of her cheeks was also fatly distorted and bruised. They had beaten her and knocked her about badly. Now that I looked for it, I could see dark splotches of dried blood on her blue shirt. And when one of the guards dragged her around roughly to face the shore, I saw that one of her hands was bandaged roughly, and that either blood or disinfectant had stained the bandages. She looked tired and ill, nearly at the end of her strength. My anger threatened to wipe out my reason. I wanted to inflict hurt upon those that had treated Sherry like this, and I had already begun to lift the rifle with hands that shook with the force of my hatred before I could control myself. I closed my eyes tightly and took a long, deep breath to steady myself. The time would come, but it was not now. When I opened my eyes again and refocused the binoculars, Suleiman Dada had the bullhorn to his lips. "Good evening, Harry, my dear friend. I am sure you recognize this young lady." He made a wide gesture towards Sherry, and she looked up at him wearily. After questioning her closely, a procedure which, alas, caused her a little discomfort,
I am at last convinced that she does not know the whereabouts of the property in which my friends and I are interested. She tells me that you have hidden it." He paused and mopped his streaming face with a towel handed to him by one of his men before he went on. "She is no longer of any interest to me, except possibly as a medium of exchange." He made a gesture, and Sherry was hustled away below. Something cold and slimy moved in my guts at her going. I wondered if I would ever see her again, alive. Onto the deserted deck filed four of Suleiman's men. Each of them had stripped to the waist, and the floodlights rippled on their smooth, darkly muscled bodies. Each of them carried the hickory wooden handles of a pickaxe, and they formed up at the points of a star about the open deck. Next, a man was led into the open center by two guards. His hands were tied behind his back. They stood on each side of him and slowly forced him to turn in a circle and show himself, while Suleiman Dada's voice boomed through the bullhorn. "I wonder if you recognize him." I stared at the stooped creature in canvas prison overalls that hung in filthy grey tatters from his gaunt frame. His skin was pale and waxy, with deep-set dark eyes. Long, scraggly blonde hair hung in greasy snakes about his face, and his half-grown beard was thin and wispy. He had lost teeth, probably knocked from his mouth with a careless blow.
"Yes, Harry?"
Suleiman laughed fruitily over the loud hailer. "A sojourn in Zanballa prison does wonders for a man, does it not? But the regulation garb is not as smart as that of an inspector of police." Only then did I recognize ex-inspector Peter Daly, the man who I had pitched from the deck of Wave Dancer into the waters of the outer lagoon just before I had escaped from Suleiman Dada by running the channel at Gunfire Reef.
"Inspector Peter Daly," Suleiman confirmed with a chuckle, "a man who let me down badly. I do not like men who let me down, Harry. I really take it very hard. I brought him along for just such an eventuality. It was a wise precaution, for I believe that a graphic demonstration is so much more convincing than mere words."
Once again he paused to mop his face and to drink deeply from a glass offered him by one of his men. Daly fell to his knees and looked up at the man on the bridge. His expression was of abject terror, and his mouth dribbled saliva as he pleaded for mercy.
"Very well. We can proceed if you are ready, Harry," he boomed.
And one of the guards produced a large black cloth bag, which he pulled over Peter Daly's head and secured with a drawn string around his neck. They dragged him roughly to his feet again.
"It's our own variation on the game of blind man's bluff."
Through the glasses, I saw the liquid flood soak through the front of Peter Daly's canvas trousers as his bladder emptied in anguished terror. Obviously, he had seen this game played before during his stay in Zanballa prison.
"Harry, I want you to use your imagination. Do not see this sniveling, filthy creature, but in his place, imagine your lovely young lady friend."
He breathed heavily, but when the man beside him offered him the towel again, Suleiman struck him a passionless, backhanded blow that sent him sprawling across the bridge, and he continued evenly,
"Imagine her lovely young body. Imagine her delicious fear as she stands in darkness, not knowing what to expect."
The two guards began to spin Daly between them, as they do in the children's game. Around and around he went, and now I could faintly hear his muffled shrieks and cries of fear. Suddenly the two guards stepped away from him and left the circle of half-naked men with their pick-handles. One of them placed the butt of his weapon in the small of Daly's back and shoved him, reeling and staggering, across the circle, and the man opposite was waiting to drive the end of his club into Daly's belly. Back and forth he staggered, driven by the thrust of the clubs.
Slowly, his tormentors increased the savagery of their attack, until one of them hefted his club and swung it like an axe at a tree. It smashed into Daly's ribs. It was the signal to end. And as Peter Daly fell to the deck, they crowded about him, the clubs rising and falling in a fearsome rhythm, and the blows sounding clearly across the lagoon to where we watched in disgust and revulsion. One after the other, they tired and stepped back to rest from their grim work, and Peter Daly's crumpled and broken body lay in the centre of the deck. "Crude, you will say, Harry, but then you will not deny that it is effective." I was sickened by the barbaric cruelty of it, and Chubby muttered beside me, "He's a monster. I've never heard of nothing like that before." "You have until noon tomorrow, Harry, to come to me unarmed and reasonable. We will talk. We will agree on certain matters. We will make an exchange of assets, and we will part friends." He stopped speaking to watch while one of his men secured a line to Peter Daly's ankle, and they hoisted him to the masthead of the crash boat, where he dangled grotesquely like some obscene pennant. Lorna Page was looking up at him, her head thrown back so the blonde hair hung down her back, and her lips were slightly parted. "If you refuse to be reasonable, Harry, then at noon tomorrow I shall sail around this island with your lady friend hanging like that." And he pointed up to the corpse, whose masked head swung slowly back and forth, only a few feet above the deck. "Hanging like that from the mast. Think about it, Harry. Take your time. Think about it well." Suddenly the floodlights were switched off, and Suleiman Dada began his laborious descent to the cabin. Manny Resnick and Lorna Page followed him. Manny was frowning slightly, as though he were pondering a business deal, but I could see that Lorna was enjoying herself.
"I think I'm going to throw up," muttered Chubby.
"Well, get it over then," I said, "because we've a lot of work to do." I stood up and quietly led the way back into the palm grove. We took it in turns to dig while the others stood guard amongst the trees. I would not use a light for fear of attracting attention from the crash boat, and we were both exaggeratedly careful to maintain silence and not to let the clank of metal on metal sound through the grove. We lifted the remaining cases of jedignite and blasting equipment. Then we did the same with the rusted pay chest and carried it to a carefully chosen site below the steeply sloping ground of the peak. 50 yards up the slope was a fold in the ground thickly screened with goosebush and salt grass. We dug another hole for the chest, going deep into the soft soil until we struck water. Then we repacked the pay chest and rebedded it. Chubby climbed up to the hidden fold above us and made his arrangements there. In the meantime, I reloaded the machine gun and wrapped it lightly in one of my old shirts, the 5 full magazines placed with it, and I bedded the lot under an inch of sand next to the stem of the nearest palm tree where the recent rainwaters had cut a shallow, dry runnel down from the slope. The water-torn trench and the tree were 40 paces from the spot where the chest was buried, and I hoped it was far enough. The trench was little more than 2 feet deep and would provide scanty cover. The moon came out after midnight, and it gave us enough light to check our arrangements. Chubby made sure I was in full view from his hideaway up the slope when I stood beside the shallow runnel. Then I climbed up to him and double-checked him. We lit a cheroot each, sheltering the match and screening the glowing tips with cupped hands while we went over our planning once again. I was particularly anxious that there should be no misunderstanding in our timing and signals, and I made Chubby repeat them twice. He did so with long-suffering and theatrical patience, but at last I was satisfied. We dumped the cheroot butts and scraped sand over them, and when we went down the slope, we both carried palm-frond brooms to sweep out all signs of activity. The first part of my planning was complete, and we returned to where the golden tiger and the rest of the jelignite was cached. We reburied the tiger, and then I prepared a full case of gelignite. It was a massive overdose of explosive, sufficient for a tenfold overkill. But I have never been a man to stint myself when I have the means to indulge. I would not be able to use the electric blaster and insulated wire, and I must rely on one of the time pencil detonators. I have a strong distaste for these temperamental little gadgets. They operate on the principle of acid eating through a thin wire, which holds the hammer on a powder cap. When the acid cuts the wire, the cap explodes, and the delay in the detonation is governed by the strength of the acid and the thickness of the wire. There can be a large latitude of error in this timing, which on one occasion caused me a nearly fatal embarrassment. However, in this case, I had no choice in the matter, and I selected a pencil with a 6-hour delay and prepared it for use with the gelignite. Amongst the equipment overlooked by the looters was my old oxygen rebreathing underwater set. This diving set is almost as dangerous to use as the time pencils. Unlike the aqualung, which uses compressed air, the rebreather employs pure oxygen, which is filtered and cleansed of carbon dioxide after each breath, and then cycled back to the user. Oxygen, breathed at pressures in excess of twice atmospheric, becomes as poisonous as carbon monoxide. In other words, if you rebreathe pure oxygen below underwater depths of 33 feet, it will kill you. You have to have all your wits together to play around with the stuff. But it has one enormous advantage. It does not blow bubbles on the surface to alarm a sentry and give away your position to him. Chubby carried the prepared case of gelignite and the rifle when we went back to the beach. It was after 3 o'clock when I had donned and tested the oxygen set, and then I carried the gelignite down to the water and tested that for buoyancy. It needed a few pounds of lead weights to give it a neutral buoyancy and make it easier to handle in the water. We had reached the water from the beach around the horn of the bay from the anchored crash boat. The point of sand and palm trees covered us as we worked, and at last I was ready. It was a long, tiring swim. I had to round the point and enter the bay a distance of almost a mile, and I had to tow the case of explosive with me. It dragged heavily through the water, and it took me almost an hour before I could see the lights of the crash boat glimmering above me through the clear water. Hugging the bottom, I crept forward slowly, terribly aware that the moonlight would silhouette me clearly against the white sand of the lagoon bed, for the water was clear as gin and only 25 feet deep. It was a relief to move slowly into the dark shadow cast by the crash boat's hull and to know that I was safe from discovery. I rested for a few minutes, then I unrolled the nylon slings that I had on my belt and secured them to the case of gelignite. Now I checked the time on my wristwatch, and the luminous hands showed 4:10. I crushed the glass ampoule of the time pencil, releasing the acid to begin its slow, eroding attack on the wire, and I returned it to its prepared slot in the case of explosive. In 6 hours, more or less, the whole lot would go up with the force of a 200-pound aerial bomb. Now I left the floor of the lagoon and rose slowly to the hull of the crash boat. It was foul with hanging, slimy beard of weeds, and the hull itself was thick with a rough scale of shellfish and gooseneck mussels. I moved slowly along the keel, searching for an anchor point, but there was nothing. And at last I was forced to use the shank of the rudder. I bound the case in position with all the nylon rope I had. And when I was finished, I was certain that it would resist even the drag of water when the crash boat was travelling at the top of her speed. Satisfied at last, I sank once more to the bed of the lagoon and moved off quietly on my return journey. I made much better speed through the water now without the burden of the gelignite case, and Chubby was waiting for me on the beach. "Fixed up?" he asked quietly as he helped me to shed the oxygen set. "Well, just as long as that pencil does its job." I was so tired now that the walk back through the grove seemed like an eternity, and my feet dragged in the loose footing. I had slept very little the previous night, and not at all since then. This time Chubby watched over me while I slept, and when he shook me gently awake it was after 7 o'clock, and the daylight was growing swiftly. We ate a breakfast cold from the can, and I finished it with a handful of high-energy glucose tablets taken from the survival kit, and washed them down with a mug of chlorinated water. I drew the knife from the sheath on my belt and threw it underhand to pin into the trunk of the nearest palm. It stood there, shivering with the force of the impact.
"Show off,"
muttered Chubby, and I grinned at him, trying to look relaxed and easy. "Look, just like the man said, no weapons." And I spread my empty hands. "You ready?" he asked. And we both stood up and looked at each other awkwardly. Chubby would never wish me good luck, which was the worst of all possible hex to put on someone.
"See you later," he said.
"Okay, Chubby." I held out my hand. He took it and squeezed it hard, and then he turned away, picked up the FN rifle, and plodded off through the grove. I watched him out of sight, but he never looked back, and I turned away myself and walked down unarmed to the beach. I walked out from amongst the trees and stood at the water's edge, staring across the narrow strip of water at the crash boat. The dangling corpse had been removed from the masthead, I saw with relief. For many seconds, none of the sentries on deck noticed me, so I raised both hands above my head and gave them a loud halloo. Instantly, there was a boil of activity and clamour of shouted orders on board the crash boat. Manny Resnick and Lorna appeared at the rail and stared across at me, while half a dozen armed seamen dropped into the whaleboat and headed for the beach. As the boat touched, they leapt out onto the sand and surrounded me with the muzzles of the AK-47s pressed eagerly into my back and belly. I kept my hands hoisted at half-mast and tried to maintain an expression of disinterest as a petty officer searched me with deliberate thoroughness for any weapon. When at last he was satisfied, he placed his hand between my shoulder blades and gave me a hearty shove towards the whaleboat. One of the more eager of his men took this as a license, and he tried to rupture my kidneys with the butt of his AK-47, but the blow landed 6 inches high. I made briskly for the whaleboat to forestall any further martial displays, and they crowded into the boat around me, pressing the muzzles of their fully loaded weapons painfully into various parts of my anatomy. Manny Resnick watched me come in over the side of the crash boat.
"Hello again, Harry," he smiled without mirth. "The pleasure's all yours, Manny."
I returned the death's head grin, and another blow caught me between the shoulder blades and drove me across the desk. I ground my teeth together to control my anger, and I thought about Sherry North. That helped. Commander Suleiman Dada was sprawled on a low couch covered with plain canvas cushions. He had removed his uniform jacket, and it hung, heavy with all the braid and medals, from a hook on the bulkhead beside him. He wore only a sweat-soaked and greyish sleeveless vest, and even this early in the morning he held a glass of pale brown liquid in his right hand.
"Ah, Harry Fletcher? Or should it be Harry Bruce?"
He grinned at me like an enormous coal-black baby.
"You take your pick, Suleiman," I invited him. But I didn't feel like playing word games with him now. I had no illusions about how dangerous was the position in which Sherry and I were placed, and my nerves were painfully tight, and fear growled like a caged animal in my belly. "I have learned so much more about you from my good friends." He indicated Manny and the blonde, Lorna, who had followed me into the main cabin.
"Fascinating, Harry. I never dreamed you were a man of such vast talent and formidable achievement."
"Thanks, Suleiman. You really are a brick, but let's not get carried away with compliments. We have important business, don't we?"
"True. True, Harry. Very true. You have raised the Tiger Throne."
"Harry, we know that,"
Manny cut in, but I shook my head.
"Only part of it. The rest is gone. But we salvaged what there was."
"All right, I'll buy that," Manny agreed. "Just tell us what there is."
Well, there's the head of the tiger, about 300 pounds weight in gold. Suleiman and Manny glanced at each other. Is that all? Manny asked. And I knew instinctively that Sherry had told them everything she knew during the beating they'd given her. I didn't hold that against her. I'd expected it. There is also the jewel chest. The stones removed from the throne were placed in an iron pay chest. The diamond. The great mogul, demanded Manny. Oh, you've got it, I said. And they murmured and smiled and nodded at each other. But I'm the only one who knows where it is, I added softly. And immediately they were tense and quiet again. This time I've got something to trade, Manny. Are you interested? We are interested, Harry. Very interested. Suleiman Dada spoke for him. And I was aware of the tension growing between my two enemies now that the loot was almost in view. I want Sherry North, I said. Sherry North? Manny stared at me for a moment and then let out a brief cough of amusement. You're a bigger fool than I thought you were, Harry. The girl is of no further interest to us. Suleiman took a swallow from his glass, and I could smell his sweat in the rising warmth of the cabin. You can have her. I want my boat, fuel, and water to get me off the island. Reasonable, Harry. Very reasonable. Manny smiled again as if at a secret joke. And I want the tiger's head. And both Manny and Suleiman laughed out loud. Oh, Harry, Harry, Suleiman chided me, still laughing. Greedy Harry, Manny stopped laughing. You can have the diamond and about 50 pounds weight of other gemstones. I tried to sell the idea with all the persuasion I could muster. It was the understandable thing to do for a man in my position. In comparison, the head is nothing. The diamond's worth a million. The head would just cover my expenses. You are a hard man, Harry, said Suleiman, chuckling. Too hard. And what will I get out of it, then? I demanded. Your life. And be grateful for it, Manny said softly. And I stared at him. I saw the coldness in his eyes, like those of a reptile. And I knew beyond all doubt what his intentions were for me, once I'd led them to the treasure. How can I trust you? I went through the motions, however, and Manny shrugged indifferently. Harry, how can you not trust us? Suleiman intervened. What could we possibly gain by killing you and your young lady? And what could you possibly lose, I thought. But I nodded and said, okay, I don't have much chance or choice. They relaxed again, smiling at each other, and Suleiman lifted his glass in a silent salute. Drink, Harry? He asked. It's a little early for me, Suleiman, I declined. But I would like to have the girl with me now. Suleiman motioned one of his men to fetch her. I want the whaleboat loaded with fuel and water and left on the beach, I went on doggedly, and Suleiman gave the orders. The girl goes with me when we go ashore, and after I've shown you the chest and the head, you'll take it and go. I stared from one to the other. You'll leave us on the island unharmed. Do we agree? Of course, Harry. Suleiman spread his hands disarmingly. We are all agreed. I was afraid they would see the disbelief in my expression, so I turned with relief to Sherry as she was led into the cabin. My relief faded swiftly as I stared at her. Harry, she whispered through her swollen purple lips. You came. Oh, God, you came. She took a faltering step towards me. Her cheek was bruised and swollen horribly, and from the extent of the edema, I thought perhaps the bone was cracked. The bruising under her eyes made her look sick and consumptive, and blood had dried in a black crust on the rims of her nostrils. I didn't want to look at her injuries, so I took her in my arms and held her to my chest. They were watching the pair of us with amusement and interest. I felt their eyes upon us, but I did not want to face them and let them see the murderous hatred that must show in my eyes.
All right, I said, let's get it over with. And when at last I turned to face them, I hoped that my expression was under control.
Unfortunately, I shall not be going with you. Suleiman made no effort to rise from the couch. Climbing in and out of small boats, walking great distances in the sun and through the sand are not my particular pleasures. I shall say farewell to you here, Harry. And my friends, and again he indicated Manny and Lorna, my friends will go with you as my representatives. Of course, you will also be accompanied by a dozen of my men, all of them armed and operating under my instructions. I thought that this warning was not entirely for my benefit alone. Goodbye, Suleiman. Perhaps we'll meet again.
I doubt it, Harry, he chuckled. But Godspeed, and my blessings go with you.
He dismissed me with one great pink-palmed paw, and with the other he raised his glass and drained the last half-inch of liquor. Sherry sat close beside me in the motorboat. She leaned against me, and her body seemed to have shriveled with the pain of her ordeal. I put my arm about her shoulders, and she whispered wearily, "They are going to kill us, Harry. You know that, don't you?" I ignored the question and asked softly, "Your hand?" It was still wrapped in the rough bandage. "What happened?" Sherry looked up at the blonde girl beside Manny Resnick, and I felt her shiver briefly against me. "She did it, Harry." Lorna Page was chatting animatedly to Manny Resnick. Her carefully lacquered hairstyle resisted the efforts of the breeze to ruffle it, and her face was meticulously made up with expensive cosmetics. Her lipstick was moist and glossy, and her eyelids were silvery green, with long mascaraed lashes around the cat's eyes. They held me, and she pulled out my fingernails. She shuddered again, and Lorna Page laughed lightly. Manny cupped his hands round a gold Dunhill lighter for her while she lit a cigarette. They kept asking me where the treasure was, and each time I couldn't answer, she pulled out a nail with the pliers. They made a tearing noise as they came out. Sherry broke off and held her injured hand protectively against her stomach. I knew how near she was to breaking completely, and I held her close, trying to transmit strength to her by physical contact. "Gently, baby, gently now," I whispered, and she pressed a little closer to me. I stroked her hair and tried once again to control my anger, bearing down hard upon it before it clouded my wits. The motorboat ran in and grounded on the beach. We climbed out and stood on the white sands, while the guards ringed us with leveled weapons.
"Okay, Harry," Manny pointed. "There's your boat, all ready for you."
The whaleboat was drawn up on the beach. The tanks are full. And when you've shown us the goods, you can take off. He spoke easily, but the girl beside him looked at us with hot, predatory eyes, the way a mongoose looks at a chicken. I wondered what way she had chosen for us. I guessed that Manny had promised us to her for her pleasure without reservations, just as soon as he was through with us.
"I hope we aren't going to play games, Harry. I hope you're going to be sensible and not waste our time."
I had noticed that Manny had surrounded himself with his own men, four of them all armed with pistols, one of them my old acquaintance who had driven the rover on our first meeting. To balance them, there were 10 black seamen under a petty officer, and already I sensed that the opposition was dividing into two increasingly hostile parties. Manny further reduced the number of seamen in the party by detailing two of them to stay with the motorboat. Then he turned to me.
"If you are ready, Harry, you may lead the way."
I had to help Sherry, holding her elbow and guiding her up through the grove. She was so weak that she stumbled repeatedly, and her breathing was distressed and ragged before we reached the caves. With a mob of armed men following us closely, we went on along the edge of the slope. Surreptitiously, I glanced at my watch. It was 9 o'clock, 1 hour to go, before the case of gelignite under the crash boat blew. The timing was still within the limits I had set. I made a small show out of locating the precise spot where the chest was buried, and it was with difficulty that I refrained from glancing up the slope to where the fold of ground was screened by vegetation. "Tell them to dig here," I said to Manny, and stepped back. Four seamen handed their weapons to a comrade and assembled the small folding army-type shovels they'd brought with them. The soil was soft and freshly turned, so they went down at an alarming speed. They would expose the chest within minutes. "The girl's hurt," I said to Manny. "She must sit down." He glanced at me, and I saw his mind work swiftly. He knew Sherry could not run far, and I think he welcomed the opportunity to distract some of the seamen, for he spoke briefly to the petty officer, and I led Sherry to the palm tree and sat her down against the stem. She sighed with weary relief, and two of the seamen came to stand over us with cocked weapons. I glanced up the slope, but there was no sign of anything suspicious there, although I knew Chubby must be watching us intently. Apart from the two guards, everyone else was gathered expectantly around the four men who were already knee-deep in the freshly dug hole. Even our two guards were consumed with curiosity. Their attention kept wandering, and they glanced repeatedly at the group 40 yards away. I heard quite clearly the clang as a spade struck the metal of the chest, and there was a shout of excitement. They all crowded round the excavation, with a babble of rising voices, beginning to pull and elbow each other for the opportunity to look down into it. Our two guards turned their backs on us and took a step or two in the same direction. It was more than I could have hoped for. Manny Resnick shoved two seamen aside roughly and jumped down into the hole beside the diggers. I heard him shouting, "All right then, bring those ropes and let's lift it out. And carefully, don't damage anything." Lorna Page was leaning out over the hole also. It was perfect. I lifted my right hand and wiped my forehead slowly in the signal I'd agreed with Chubby. And as I dropped my hand again, I seized Sherry and rolled swiftly backwards into the shallow, rain-washed runnel. It caught Sherry by surprise, and I'd handled her roughly in my anxiety to get her under cover. She cried out as I hurt her already painful injuries. The two guards whirled at the cry, lifting their machine guns, and I knew that they were going to fire, and that the shallow trench provided no cover. Now, Chubby, now, I prayed, and threw myself on top of Sherry to shield her from the blast of machine gun fire, and I clapped both hands over her ears to protect them. At that instant, Chubby switched the knob on the electric battery blaster, and the impulse ran down the insulated wire that we'd carefully concealed the night before. There was half a case of gelignite crammed into the iron pay chest, as much explosive as I dared use, without destroying Sherry and myself in the blast. I imagined Chubby's fiendish glee as the case blew. It blew upwards, deflected by the sides of the excavation. But I had packed the sticks of gelignite with sand and handfuls of semi-precious stones to serve as primitive shrapnel and to contain the blast and make it even more vicious. The group of men around the hole were lifted high in the air, spinning and somersaulting like a troop of insane acrobats, and a column of sand and dust shot 100 feet into the air. The earth jarred under us, slamming into our prone bodies, and then the shockwave tore across us. It knocked sprawling the two guards who'd been about to fire down on us, ripping their clothing from their bodies. I thought my eardrums had both burst. I was completely deafened. But I knew that I'd saved Sherry's ears from damage. Deafened and half-blinded by dust, I rolled off Sherry and scratched frantically in the sandy bottom of the trench. My fingers hit the machine gun buried there, and I dragged it out, pulling off the protective rags and coming swiftly to my knees. Both the guards nearest me were alive, one crawling to his knees and the other sitting up dazedly with blood from a burst eardrum trickling down his cheek. I killed them with two short bursts that knocked them down in the sand. Then I looked towards the broken heap of humanity around the excavation. There was small, convulsive movement there and soft moans and whimpering sounds. I stood up shakily from the trench, and I saw Chubby standing up on the slope. He was shouting, but I heard nothing for the ringing, buzzing din in my ears. I stood there, swaying slightly, peering stupidly around me, and Sherry rose to her feet beside me.
She touched my shoulder, saying something, and with relief I heard her voice as the ringing in my ears subsided slightly. I looked again towards the area of the explosion and saw a strange and frightening thing. A half-human figure, stripped of clothing and most of its skin. A raw, bleeding thing with one arm half torn loose at the shoulder socket and dangling at its side by a shred of flesh, rose slowly from beside the excavation like some horrible phantom from the grave. It stood like that for a long moment, which it took me to recognize Manny Resnick. It seemed impossible that he should have survived the Holocaust. But more than that, he began walking towards me. He tottered step after step closer and closer, and I stood frozen, unable to move. I saw then that he was blinded. The flying sand had scorched his eyeballs and flayed the skin from his face. "Oh, God! Oh, God!" Sherry whispered beside me, and it broke the spell. I lifted the machine gun, and the stream of bullets that tore into Manny Resnick's chest were a mercy. I was still dazed, staring about me at the shambles we'd created, when Chubby reached me. He took my arm, and I could hear his voice as he shouted, "Are you okay, Harry?" I nodded, and he went on, "The whaleboat. We've got to make sure of the whaleboat." I turned to Sherry. "Go to the cave. Wait for me there." And she turned away obediently. "Make sure of these first," I mumbled to Chubby. And we went to the heap of bodies about the shattered iron chest. All of them were dead, or would soon be so. Elona Page lay upon her back. The blast had torn off her outer clothing, and the slim, pale body was clad only in lacy underwear, with shreds of the green slack suit hanging from her wrists and draped about her torn and still bleeding legs. Defying even the explosion, her hairstyle retained its lacquered elegance, except for the powdering of fine white sand. Death had played a macabre joke upon her, for a lump of blue lapis lazuli from the jewel chest had been driven by the force of the explosion deep into her forehead. It had embedded itself in the bone of her skull, like the eye of the tiger from the Golden Throne. Her own eyes were closed, while the third precious eye of stone glared up at me accusingly.
"They're all dead," grunted Chubby. "Yes, they're dead," I agreed, and tore my eyes away from the mutilated girl.
I was surprised that I felt no triumph or satisfaction at her death, nor at the manner of it. Vengeance, far from being sweet, is entirely tasteless, I thought, as I followed Chubby down to the beach. I was still unsteady from the effects of the explosion, and although my ears had recovered almost entirely, I was hard-pressed to keep up with Chubby. He was light on his feet for such a big man. I was 10 paces behind him as we came out of the trees and stopped at the head of the beach. The whaleboat lay where we'd left her, but the 2 seamen detailed to guard the motorboat must have heard the explosion and decided to take no chances. They were halfway back to the crash boat already, and when they saw Chubby and me, one of them fired his machine gun in our direction. The range was far beyond the accurate limits of the weapon, and we didn't bother to take cover. However, the firing attracted the attention of the crew remaining aboard the crash boat, and I saw 3 of them run forward to man the quickfirer in the bows. Here comes trouble, I murmured. The first round was high and wide, cracking into the palms behind us and pitting their stems with a burst of shrapnel. Chubby and I moved quickly back into the grove and lay flat behind the sandy crest of the beach.
What now? Chubby asked.
Stalemate, I told him. And the next 2 rounds from the quickfire burst in futile fury in the trees above and behind us. But then there was a delay of a few seconds, and I saw them training the gun around. The next shot lifted a tall, graceful spout of water from the shallows alongside the whaleboat. Chubby let out a roar of anger like a lioness whose cub is threatened.
"They're trying to take out the whaleboat," he bellowed,
as the next round tore into the beach in a brief spurt of soft sand.
"Give it to me," I snapped,
and took the FN from him. Thrusting the short-barreled AK-47 at him and lifting the strap of the haversack off Chubby's shoulders, his marksmanship was not equal to the finer work that was now necessary. "Stay here," I told him, and I jumped up and doubled away around the curve of the bay. I had almost entirely recovered from the effects of the blast now, and as I reached the horn of the bay nearest the anchored crash boat, I fell flat on my belly in the sand and pushed forward the long barrel of the FN. The gun crew were still blazing away at the whaleboat, and spouts of sand and water rose in rapid succession about it. The plate of frontal armour of the gun was aimed diagonally away from me, and the backs and flanks of the gun crew were exposed. I pushed the rate of fire selector of the FN onto a single shot, and drew a few long, deep breaths to steady my aim after the long run through the soft sand. I pushed the rate of fire selector onto the single shot, checked it. The gun layer was peddling the traversing and elevating handles of the gun, and had his forehead pressed hard against the pad above the eyepiece of the gun sight. I picked him up in the peep sight and squeezed off a single shot. It knocked him off his seat and flung him sideways across the breech of the gun. The untended aiming handle spiraled idly, and the barrel of the gun lifted lazily towards the sky. The two gun loaders looked around in amazement, and I squeezed off two more snapshots at them. Their amazement was altered instantly to panic, and they deserted their posts, sprinted back along the deck, and dived into an open hatchway. I swung my aim across and up to the open bridge of the crash boat. Three shots into the assembled officers and seamen produced a gratifying chorus of yells, and the bridge cleared miraculously. The motorboat from the beach came alongside, and I hastened the two seamen up the side and into the deckhouse with three more rounds. They neglected to make the boat fast, and it drifted away from the side of the crash boat. I changed the magazine of the FN, and then, carefully and deliberately, I put a single bullet through each porthole on the near side of the boat. I could clearly hear the shattering clack of glass at each shot. This proved too much provocation for Commander Suleiman Dada. I heard the donkey winch clatter to life, and the anchor chain streamed in over the bows, glistening with seawater, and the moment the fluked anchor broke out through the surface, the crash boat's propellers churned a whitewash of water under her stern, and she swung round towards the opening of the lagoon. I kept her under fire as she moved slowly past my hiding place, lest she change her mind about leaving. The bridge was screened by a windshield of dirty white canvas, and I knew the helmsman was lying behind this with his head well down. I fired shot after shot through the canvas, trying to guess his position. There was no apparent effect, so I turned my attention to the portholes again, hoping for a lucky ricochet within the hull. The crash boat picked up speed rapidly until she was waddling along like an old lady hurrying to catch a bus. She rounded the horn of the bay, and I stood up and brushed off the sand. Then I reloaded the rifle and broke into a trot through the palm grove. By the time I reached the north tip of the island and climbed high enough up the slope to look out over the deep water channel, the crash boat was a mile away, heading resolutely for the distant mainland of Africa, a small white shape against the shaded greens of the sea and the higher, harsher blue of the sky. I tucked the FN under my arm and found a seat from where I could watch her further progress. My wristwatch showed 7 minutes past 10 o'clock, and I began to wonder if the case of gelignite below the crash boat's stern had, after all, been torn loose by the drag of the water and the wash of the propellers. The crash boat was now passing between the submerged outer reefs before entering the open inshore waters. The reefs blew regularly, breathing white foam at each surge of the sea as though a monster lay beneath the surface. The small white speck of the crash boat seemed ethereal and insubstantial in that wilderness of sea and sky. Soon she would merge with the wind-flecked and current-chopped waters of the open sea. The explosion, when it came, was without passion, its violence muted by distance, and its sound toned by the wind. There was a sudden, soft waterspout that enveloped the tiny white boat. It looked like an ostrich feather, soft and blowing on the wind, bending when it reached its full height, and then losing its shape and smearing away across the choppy surface. The sound reached me many seconds later, a single, unwarlike thud,
against my still tender eardrums, and I thought I felt the flap of the blast like the puff of the wind against my face. When the spray had blown into nothingness, the channel was empty. No sign remained of the tiny vessel, and there was no mark of her going upon the wind-blown waters. I knew that with the tide, the big, evil-looking albacore sharks hunted inshore upon the flood. They'd be quick to the taint of blood and torn flesh in the water, and I doubted that any of those aboard the crash-boat who had survived the blast would long avoid the attentions of those single-minded and voracious killers. Those that found Commander Suleiman Dada would fare well, I thought, unless they recognized a kindred spirit and accorded him professional privilege. It was a grim little joke, and it gave me only a fleeting amusement. I stood up and walked down to the caves.